The first thing I noticed was the blood on his shirt. Not a lot. Just a dark stain spreading slowly near his ribs, barely visible beneath the heavy fabric of his coat. But I noticed it the way I always noticed things that didn't belong. Quietly. Completely. The way a person learns to read danger before danger reads them. The back door of the restaurant swung open at 11:47 p.m., and he was simply there. A man so large he had to angle his shoulders to fit through the frame, one hand pressed flat against the wall, like the building was the only thing holding him upright. His eyes swept the kitchen in less than a second. Dark eyes. The kind that didn't ask questions. They issued them. I was the only one still there. Every other staff member had clocked out an hour ago. I'd stayed behind to finish the inventory count because Marco, our manager, had forgotten to do it again and left the job to whoever was last standing. That was almost always me. Rose Callahan, 23 years old, 5'4", blonde hair pulled back with a rubber band because I'd lost my clip somewhere between table 7 and the dishwasher. The girl who stayed late. The girl who didn't make noise. The girl who, apparently, was now staring at a wounded stranger who had just walked through her kitchen door like he owned the building and everything inside it. "You're bleeding," I said. It wasn't a question. It wasn't even helpful. It was just the truth falling out of my mouth before I could stop it. His gaze landed on me like a stone dropped from a great height, heavy and precise. He didn't answer. He looked around the kitchen again instead, the prep stations, the industrial refrigerators humming in the corner, the single light still burning above the sink. Then he looked back at me. "How many exits?" he asked. His voice was low, controlled. The kind of calm that doesn't come naturally. It comes from practice. "3, I said, before I fully understood why I was answering him. "Back door, the one you came through. Side door near the dry storage. And the front. But the dining room lights are off, and I can't lock the main entrance from in here." He processed this without blinking. There was something almost animal in the way he held still. Not relaxed, but coiled. Aware of everything. "How long until someone comes?" "Marco does the morning prep at 5:30. That's almost 6 hours. The sound of something outside, tires on wet pavement, a vehicle moving slowly, made his posture shift. Just slightly. But I saw it. A crack in that perfect stillness. "Keep quiet," I heard myself say. The words surprised me. "I'll hide you in the kitchen." I don't know what made me say it. I don't know what made me mean it. Maybe it was the way his jaw tightened when he heard that car. Maybe it was the way someone who looks that dangerous can also, in the right light, look terribly alone. Maybe it was just the habit of helping that had been drilled into me since I was old enough to carry plates. He looked at me for a long moment. "You don't know who I am," he said. "No," I agreed. "And right now that's probably better for both of us." My name, Rose Callahan, had never meant much in this town. I'd grown up in Dryfield, a mid-sized city that sat at the edge of two territories that most ordinary people pretended not to know about. The kind of town where you learned early that some streets were safer than others at certain hours, and that when black SUVs moved in convoys through downtown, you looked the other way and kept walking. I waited tables at Embers, a restaurant that occupied that particular category of not quite fancy, but too expensive to be casual. We served steak and red wine, and kept the lighting low enough that people could have conversations they didn't want remembered. I had worked there for 2 years. I knew how to be invisible, how to refill a glass without interrupting a sentence, how to clear a plate without making eye contact. I had learned that skill not in restaurant training, but long before. Growing up, invisibility had been a form of survival. My father had been a man of moods, enormous highs, devastating silences. My mother had moved around him like a moth around a flame, always adjusting her orbit, never quite landing. I had learned to read rooms before I could read books. I learned which silences were safe and which ones were the held breath before a storm. I carried that skill with me everywhere. Into school, where I watched social dynamics like a researcher rather than participating. Into friendships that always felt slightly tilted, like I was a supporting character in other people's stories. Into this kitchen, where I could tell by the way the sous chef slammed a pot down that it was going to be a rough service before the first ticket even printed. I noticed things. I stayed quiet about them. And apparently, when a dangerous man with a bleeding wound came through my back door, my instincts decided he was something worth protecting. I pulled him toward the dry storage room, a narrow space behind the main kitchen lined with shelves of canned goods, flour bags, and industrial-sized olive oil. It wasn't comfortable. It wasn't meant to be. But the walls were thick, the door was heavy, and there was no window. "Sit," I said, pointing to an overturned crate. He sat. The fact that he sat, that this enormous, coiled, dangerous person simply sat down because I'd said so, rattled me more than I let on. I grabbed the first aid kit from the hook near the fire extinguisher. It was meant for minor kitchen accidents. Burns, cuts, nothing serious. I didn't know if it would be enough. "I need to see it," I said. He pulled the coat aside without comment. The shirt beneath was dark, but I could see the tear in the fabric, the source of the slow spread. It wasn't deep. I let out a breath I hadn't known I was holding. A cut along the side, long, but not dangerous. Whoever had done this hadn't been aiming to end him. They'd been trying to mark him, or slow him down. "This is going to sting," I said. "I'm aware of what antiseptic feels like," he replied, and there was something in his tone that wasn't quite irritation and wasn't quite humor, something in between. I cleaned the wound in silence. My hands were steady, a skill acquired from years of carrying full trays through crowded dining rooms, from never letting anyone see me rattled. He didn't make a sound. He sat completely still, watching me work with an expression I couldn't read. "You're not afraid," he said. "I'm terrified," I corrected him. "I'm just also practical." That silenced him. Outside, the slow-rolling vehicle passed, then another. I heard voices, distant, muffled, the sharp cadence of people looking for something specific. My hands kept moving. I pressed gauze to the wound and held it, watching his face for signs of more damage, the kind that doesn't show up on the surface. "What did they want?" I asked quietly. "The same thing everyone wants," he said. "Power. Control. For me to disappear." "Are you going to?" His dark eyes found mine. "Not tonight." I finished securing the bandage, smoothed the edge of the tape down, and sat back on my heels. The voices outside faded. The vehicles moved on. The kitchen hummed and the refrigerators kept their steady, indifferent rhythm. "Thank you," he said. It sounded like a word he didn't use often. "Don't thank me yet," I said. "You still have 6 hours until the morning prep cook gets here, and you're sitting in my dry storage room between the bread flour and the canned tomatoes." Something shifted in his expression. Not a smile, not quite, but something loosened, just slightly. "Theron," he said. I looked at him. "My name," he said. "You hid me without knowing it. Seems fair that you know at least that much." I thought about not giving him mine. I thought about what it would mean to keep that distance, that professional wall, the one I'd built and maintained for years, the one that kept me safe from getting involved in things that were larger than me. "Rose," I said. He repeated it quietly, like he was cataloging it, like it was something he intended to remember. Outside, the rain had begun again, tapping against the kitchen's high, narrow windows. The city beyond them was doing its usual business of looking the other way, and I was sitting on the floor of a storage room with a man named Theron, who had come through my back door like a storm that had learned to walk upright. I didn't yet know who he was to this city. I didn't know what that word meant. Alpha King. in any way that felt real or immediate. But I would. By morning, I would understand exactly what I had done. I didn't sleep that night. After Theron's breathing steadied and I was certain the vehicles outside had moved on for good, I'd found him an old staff jacket, the kind we kept on a hook near the back for deliveries in cold weather, and left him in the dry storage room with a bottle of water and strict instructions not to open the door for any reason unless I knocked 3 times first. Then I went back to the kitchen, sat on a stool near the prep counter, and pretended to finish the inventory. The numbers blurred. I wrote things down that I'd already counted. I erased them. I wrote them again. My mind kept returning to the sound of those vehicles moving slowly through the wet street outside. The precision of it. The patience. Whoever was looking for Theron wasn't panicking. They were methodical. That was worse. Panicked people made mistakes. Methodical people had plans. I'd grown up in Dryfield. I knew the shape of this city's underworld the way you know the layout of a house you grew up in. Not because anyone sat you down and explained it, but because you absorbed it through walls and silences and the particular way adults changed the subject when certain things came up. There were 2 dominant territories in this region. The eastern side, which operated under a council, organized, political, visible enough to have opinions about city zoning, and the western territory, which was older, less visible, and answered to a single authority. The Alpha King. I had heard that title the way you hear the names of things that exist in the category of not your concern. A phrase passed between people at the bar when someone had 1 too many drinks. A name spoken in a specific tone, not reverent, not fearful exactly, but careful. The way you say the name of a storm that already passed through once and left marks. I had never connected that title to a face, to a person, to a man sitting in my dry storage room between the bread flour and the canned tomatoes, with a cut along his ribs and eyes that processed the world like a military map. By 3 in the morning, I'd made a decision. I didn't examine it too closely, because examining decisions too closely had a way of talking me out of the right ones. I put down my clipboard, walked to the storage room, and knocked 3 times. The door opened immediately. He hadn't slept either. "I need you to be gone before 4:30, I said. "Marco sometimes comes early when he can't sleep. If he finds you here, I lose my job. And I need this job." Theron looked at me steadily. He had removed the borrowed jacket, refolded it, and placed it neatly on the shelf beside him. Even wounded and hiding in a storage room, there was a precision to him that I found both unsettling and, against my better judgment, quietly reassuring. "I'll be gone by 4, he said. "Thank you." I turned to leave. "Rose." I stopped. "They'll ask questions," he said. "In the morning. People will come to this restaurant asking whether anything unusual happened last night." I turned back slowly. "And what would you like me to say?" "Whatever you decide to say," he replied. "Say it consistently. People who are hiding something change their story. People who are telling the truth don't need to rehearse it." I stared at him. "That sounds like advice from someone who has lied professionally." "It's advice from someone who has watched others get caught," he said. And then, quieter, "I won't let anything happen to you because of tonight. That's a promise." I thought about what the promises of powerful men were worth. I thought about my father, who had made promises the way other people made grocery lists, freely and without real intention of keeping them. "I don't need your protection," I said. "I just need you to be gone before 4:30. He nodded once. I went back to the kitchen. He was gone by 3:50. The morning came the way mornings always do after long nights. Indifferent, bright, slightly cruel. I went home, showered, slept for 2 hours, and returned to Embers for the lunch shift because I needed the money, and because staying home would have given me too much time to think. Marco was in a good mood, which meant he'd managed to sleep. The other waitstaff filtered in. Donna, who had worked at Embers for 11 years and knew everything about everyone. Paolo, 21 and still in the phase of life where he thought charm was a substitute for punctuality. And Celia, who was my closest thing to a friend in this place, and who noticed immediately that something was wrong with me. "You look like you didn't sleep," Celia said, tying her apron beside me near the hostess stand. "Inventory ran late," I said. She looked at me sideways. "Marco left you with inventory again?" "Marco leaves me with everything," I said, which was true enough to be believed. The lunch service was routine. Business people, a few tourists, a table of older women who lingered over sparkling water and salads for an hour and a half. I moved through my sections on autopilot, smiling at the right moments, refilling glasses before they were empty, being invisible in all the ways the job required. It was nearly 2 o'clock when they came in. Three of them. Two men flanking a woman who walked like the concept of other people's opinions had simply never applied to her. She was striking, severe in the way that beautiful things sometimes are, dark hair, a coat that cost more than my monthly rent. She scanned the dining room, the way Theron had scanned the kitchen the night before, like a person looking for something specific. Donna seated them in my section. Of course she did. I approached the table with my order pad and my best professional expression, the one that communicated I am efficient and forgettable, which was usually exactly what I wanted. "Good afternoon," I said. "Can I start you with something to drink?" The woman looked up at me. Her eyes were sharp, the kind of sharp that wasn't just intelligence, but assessment. She was cataloging me. "Water," she said. "Still." Then, as I turned to the other two, "Were you working last night?" I kept my face neutral. I had learned this too, the ability to keep my face from broadcasting what my nervous system was doing. "Yes," I said. I closed. "Can I ask what this is about?" "We're looking into an incident that may have occurred in this area," she said. Her tone was the temperature of a file cabinet. "A man was seen near this street sometime after midnight. Large. Dark coat." "I didn't see anyone," I said. "The restaurant closes at 11. I finished up the back of housework alone and left just after midnight. The street was empty when I walked to my car." She watched me. I didn't fidget. I didn't add anything. People who are hiding something over-explain. People telling the truth don't need to rehearse. His words, his voice. Somehow they'd lodged in me overnight like something I'd always known. "Your name?" she asked. "Rose," I said. "Rose Callahan." She wrote it down. Something about seeing my name in her notebook made my chest tighten, but I kept breathing. "Thank you, Rose," she said. And the way she said it made it clear the conversation was over. I brought them their water. I took their order. I served their food. I smiled exactly the right amount. They left at 3 without looking at me again. Celia appeared at my elbow the moment the door closed behind them. "Who were those people?" "Health inspectors," I said. "Something about a complaint from a neighboring business." Celia wrinkled her nose. "They didn't look like health inspectors." "No," I agreed. "They really didn't." 3 days passed. I worked my shifts, counted my tips, went home to my small apartment on Vern Street, where the radiator made sounds like a conversation between two people who didn't like each other. I told myself that whatever had happened in that kitchen was finished. That Theron was gone, and whoever was looking for him hadn't found enough to come back. I almost believed it. On the 4th evening, there was an envelope under my apartment door, plain white. My name on the front, handwritten in precise, economical letters. No return address. Inside was a single card. On it, a phone number. And below that, 3 words. "When you're ready." I sat with it for a long time. The radiator argued with itself in the corner. Outside, a car passed. Then another. I thought about the way he'd said my name. quiet and careful, like he was storing it somewhere specific. I thought about the promise he'd made, and what it felt like to have it made at all. I thought about the woman with the notebook writing Rose Callahan in ink, and how small and exposed that had made me feel. I thought about the fact that I had made a choice that night in the kitchen. Not a calculated one, not a smart one necessarily, just an instinctive one. And that choice had already pulled me into something that didn't have clean edges. I put the card in the drawer beside my bed. I didn't call. Not that night. I called on a Tuesday, 7 days after finding the envelope. 7 days of going to work, serving food, smiling at strangers, going home, staring at the ceiling. 7 days of telling myself that the smartest thing I could do was nothing. Stay in my lane. Keep my head down. Let whatever world Theron belonged to continue turning without my involvement. But on the 7th night, I couldn't sleep again. And the reason I couldn't sleep wasn't fear, exactly. It was something more inconvenient than fear. It was the feeling that something had already shifted, and pretending otherwise was just wasted energy. I picked up the phone at 11:43 p.m. I dialed the number from memory because I had accidentally memorized it sometime around day 3. It rang twice. Rose. Not a question. He'd known it would be me. "You left your number under my door," I said. That felt like an invitation. "It was," he said. "Are you safe?" The question surprised me. Not what do you want, or why are you calling? Just that. Direct and quiet. "Are you safe?" "Yes," I said. "A woman came to the restaurant the day after. Dark hair, expensive coat, two men with her. She asked about that night." A pause. "What did you tell her?" "That I didn't see anyone, that I left at midnight and the street was empty." Another pause, longer this time. "She believed you?" "I think so. She wrote my name down." "I know," he said. "I'm sorry for that." "I didn't call to get an apology," I said. "I called because I want to understand what I'm involved in. I think I deserve that much." The silence on his end had texture to it. Not empty, but full of something being considered. "Not over the phone," he finally said. "Can you meet me?" He sent a car. Not a flashy one. A dark, unremarkable sedan, with a driver who introduced himself only as Len, spoke exactly 4 words the entire drive, and delivered me to a building on the north end of the city that looked from the outside like a closed architectural firm. Inside, it was different. Not lavish. That wasn't the right word. But everything in it was intentional. Clean lines, dark wood, the low hum of a building that was occupied and protected and very deliberately difficult to find. Men moved through the corridors with the particular efficiency of people who had been trained not to waste motion. No one looked at me with hostility. Several of them looked at me with careful, neutral curiosity. The kind that comes from being around someone who does unexpected things. Theron met me in a room that served as some kind of study or meeting space. Bookshelves, a large table, a window that looked out onto an interior courtyard, where a few bare trees stood in the late October cold. He was standing when I came in. He looked different than he had in the kitchen. Not the wound, which I assumed had been properly treated, but his posture. Here, he was fully himself. The coiled wariness from the kitchen was still present, but underneath it was something else. Authority that didn't need to announce itself. He was wearing a dark sweater, no coat. The cut along his ribs was presumably healing beneath it. He looked at me the way he'd looked at me in that storage room. Completely, without the social habit most people had of looking slightly past someone while giving the impression of attention. "You came," he said. "You said when you're ready," I replied. "Not if." Something in his expression shifted. "Sit down, Rose." I sat. He sat across from me, and for a moment neither of us said anything. The building hummed around us. One of the bare trees in the courtyard moved slightly in the wind. "The woman who came to your restaurant," he began. "Her name is Sarah Voss. She sits on the Eastern Council. She's been trying to locate me for several weeks, not to negotiate and not to ask questions. She wants leverage, and she was getting close."
Which is why you were running that night," I said. "I wasn't running," he said, and there was a quiet firmness to it that I believed immediately. "I was choosing terrain. There's a difference. I let them think they'd cornered me on that street. I needed them to commit their positioning so I could map how many they'd moved and where." I looked at him. "You got yourself hurt on purpose?" "The wound was a consequence I accepted," he said, which wasn't quite an answer, but also somehow was. "And now?" "Now Sarah Voss knows my location was near Embers that night. She doesn't know what I found there." He paused. "She doesn't know about you." "Yet," I said. "Yet," he agreed. He didn't soften it, which I respected. "So what do you need from me?" I asked. "Because I'm a waitress, Theron. I count inventory and carry plates, and I'm very good at being invisible. But I'm not..." "I know what you are," he said quietly. The way he said it stopped me. Not with force, but with a certainty that felt like it had been arrived at through observation rather than assumption. "You made a decision in that kitchen that most people wouldn't have made," he said. "Not because you didn't understand the risk. You understood it immediately. I could see that. You made it anyway. That's not nothing. That's actually quite rare." I thought about what to say to that. I settled on the truth. "I don't know why I did it. It wasn't calculation. It was just instinct. Instinct is just accumulated wisdom that arrives faster than thought," he said. "Don't dismiss it." We sat with that for a moment. In the courtyard, two of his people crossed between buildings, shoulders hunched against the cold, exchanging a few words before separating. A whole ecosystem of loyalty and risk, functioning in the background of this conversation. "I'm not asking you to be involved," Theron said. "I want to be clear about that. What I want is to make sure that what I pulled you into doesn't follow you. Sarah Voss wrote your name in a notebook. I'd like to ensure that name stays unremarkable to her." "How?" "By giving her something else to focus on," he said. "We're moving against the council's interests in a specific financial matter next week. When that happens, your name will be the least interesting thing in Sarah Voss's life." I absorbed this. "And until then?" "Until then," he said carefully, "I'd like to know you're not alone." I almost made a sharp comment about that. About not needing protection. About being perfectly capable of managing my own life. I had the comment fully formed, ready to deliver. Instead, I heard myself say, "I've been alone for a long time. I'm used to it." It wasn't what I'd intended to say. It came from somewhere deeper than the sharp comment. From the part of me that had learned to be invisible so thoroughly that sometimes I forgot there was a difference between chosen solitude and loneliness that had simply become a habit. Theron looked at me for a long moment. "So have I," he said. I didn't go home that night until nearly 1 a.m. Len drove me back in the same quiet sedan, and I sat in the back and watched the city pass outside the window. Its ordinary streets, its closed storefronts, its streetlights catching the first thin suggestion of November rain. In the following days, I learned things. Not because Theron told me directly, but because I asked, carefully, specifically. And he answered in the way that some people answer when they're not accustomed to being asked, but find that they don't mind it. I learned that the Alpha King title wasn't ceremonial. It was functional. A leadership structure that had existed in this region for over a century, governing a population that lived alongside the ordinary world but had never been part of it. Wolves, in the oldest sense of the word. Not a myth, not a metaphor. I had grown up in this city, and I had known this in the vague, carefully not examined way that you know things you've decided not to think about. But knowing it abstractly and sitting across a table from the person who held that authority were very different experiences. "Does it change things?" Theron asked, when I went quiet after he explained it plainly for the first time, without metaphor or evasion. Knowing what I am, I thought about it honestly, about the kitchen, the wound, the promise, about the card under my door and the Tuesday phone call in Sarah Voss's notebook. "It explains some things," I said. "The way you moved, the way you looked at the room." "And?" "And I already made my decision," I said, "in the kitchen. I'm not going to unmake it now just because the context got bigger." He studied me with those dark, steady eyes. And for the first time since the night of the storm and the back door and the bread flour and the canned tomatoes, something in his expression moved toward something that wasn't quite wariness and wasn't quite hope. It was somewhere in between. Which, I was beginning to understand, was exactly where the two of us had always been going to end up. November arrived the way it always does in Dryfield. Without ceremony, just a gradual tightening of the air, and a sky that forgot how to be blue. I kept working my shifts at Embers. I kept being invisible, reliable, forgettable in all the ways the job required. But something had changed in the architecture of my days. There was a new layer to them, a second life running quietly beneath the surface of the ordinary one. Twice a week, Len picked me up after my closing shift and drove me to the North Building. Sometimes Theron was there waiting. Sometimes I arrived first and sat in that study with its bare tree courtyard and its bookshelves, and read until he appeared, coat still cold from outside, carrying the particular kind of exhaustion that comes not from physical effort, but from the weight of sustained vigilance. We talked. That was the simple, strange truth of it. We talked in the way that people talk when they've both spent long stretches of their lives not being genuinely listened to, carefully at first, then with increasing honesty, the way a window lets in more light as you open it further. He told me about the Council's campaign to fracture the Western Territory's alliances, about Sarah Voss, who had spent 3 years building relationships with the smaller packs at the edges of Theron's territory, not through force, but through economic pressure, through resource control, through the slow, patient work of making people feel that loyalty to the Alpha King was a liability they couldn't afford. "She's not wrong that it's working," he said one evening, standing at the courtyard window with his arms crossed, looking out at the dark trees. "Three families have pulled back from our agreements in the last 4 months. Not enemies, just absent. And absence, in this kind of structure, is its own message." "It's isolation," I said. He turned to look at me. "She's not trying to defeat you directly," I said. "She's trying to make you seem defeatable. If enough people quietly step back, the ones who haven't start wondering if they should. It's not about the three families. It's about what those three families signal to everyone else." He was quiet for a moment. "Yes," he said. "Exactly that. I've seen it before," I said. "Smaller scale, in kitchens, in restaurants. When management wants someone out, they don't always fire them. They just slowly stop including them. Fewer shifts, fewer tables. No one asks their opinion anymore. The person starts to wonder if they imagined ever belonging. And then they leave on their own." Theron looked at me with an expression I was learning to read. Not surprise, exactly, but a recalibration. The look of someone adjusting their internal estimate of a person upward. "You're describing something you've experienced," he said. "I hadn't meant to go that far." "I'm describing something I've observed," I said, which was half true. He didn't push it. He had a quality I'd noticed and privately valued. He never pushed when I pulled back. He simply noted the door I'd closed and waited, without impatience, to see if I'd open it again. I did, eventually. Not that night, but 2 nights later, when we were both sitting with coffee going cold on the table between us, and the rain had started again outside. My father was the kind of person who made you feel invisible as a strategy, I said. Not consciously, maybe. But he understood that the most effective way to control someone was to make them doubt whether they took up any real space. If you don't believe your presence matters, you don't fight for it. Theron said nothing. He listened with the entirety of his attention, which I was learning was different from most people's listening. Most people listen while simultaneously preparing their response. He listened as though your words were arriving somewhere and being held. I spent a lot of years being very good at being small, I said. It kept things peaceful, or what passed for peace. I looked at my coffee cup. I'm still unlearning it. You don't seem small to me, he said. His voice was quiet and even, without performance. You came through my back door bleeding, I said. You needed someone in that moment. People seem larger when you need them. That's not what I meant, he said. And then, after a pause, the night I came through that door, I had three options for where to go. Two of them were strategically sound, safer, in practical terms. I chose the third, because something in that building felt... He stopped, considered. Not safe exactly, but honest. I don't have a better word for it. I looked at him. A kitchen where someone was working alone at midnight, he said, because the work needed to be done and she was the one still there to do it. That told me something. I didn't know what to say to that. So I said nothing, and we sat with the rain against the windows and the coffee going cold, and it was the most comfortable silence I could remember in a very long time. The situation with Sarah Voss moved faster than Theron had anticipated. On a Thursday morning, 2 weeks into November, I arrived at Ember's for the opening shift to find Marco waiting for me at the back door, with an expression that he only wore when something had gone wrong that he didn't know how to categorize. There were people here this morning, he said, before I opened. Waiting. What kind of people? Suit kind, he said. Asked about you, about your hours, your schedule, whether you'd had any unusual visitors recently. He paused. I told them nothing, Rose, but I need you to tell me what's going on. I had prepared for this. Not specifically this, but the shape of it. The moment when the world I'd briefly stepped into came looking for me in the world I actually lived in. I don't know exactly, I said, which was partly true. I think I may have been seen near something I wasn't supposed to be seen near. I'm handling it. Marco looked at me for a long moment. He was a complicated man. Not cruel, not kind exactly. Lazy in many ways, but fair in the particular way of people who don't have the energy for pettiness. You need anything? He said. I need today's shift, I said. And I need normal. He nodded. Normal I can do. I texted Theron from the staff bathroom. Three sentences. They came to my workplace this morning. Asked about me specifically. It's moving. His reply came in under a minute. I know. Don't change anything. I'll contact you tonight. I put my phone in my apron pocket and went out to set tables. The shift passed. I was efficient. Invisible. Professional. Inside, my mind was running the math of what Sarah Voss coming to my restaurant meant. She hadn't believed me entirely. Or she had believed me and considered me a loose thread worth pulling. Either way, she'd made a move that crossed into my ordinary life, and that changed the calculation of everything. Celia found me during the afternoon lull, both of us folding napkins at the service station. Those people this morning, she said quietly. I saw them when I came in. Rose, they weren't inspectors. I know, I said. Are you in trouble? I thought about the honest answer to that question. I thought about Theron and the North Building and the bare trees in the courtyard and the card under my door and the Tuesday phone call. I thought about my name in Sarah Voss's notebook and what it meant to have been seen. I'm in something, I said. I don't think it's trouble, but it's definitely something. Celia looked at me with the specific expression she wore when she was deciding whether to press or let go. She let go. Okay, she said. But if you need a place to stay that's not your apartment, my couch is available. I looked at her, and something in my chest moved in the direction of gratitude that had nowhere else to go. Thank you, I said. That evening, Len didn't come for me. Instead, Theron arrived himself, on foot, without the coat, which struck me as unusual. He was waiting outside Embers when I finished my shift, standing under the awning in the thin rain with his hands in his pockets, looking like a person who had made a decision and was at peace with it. Walk with me, he said. We walked for several blocks without speaking, the city damp and quiet around us. Finally, he stopped at a corner under a streetlight and turned to face me. Sarah Voss knows your name and your workplace, he said. She's going to try to use you as pressure. Not against you directly, against me. She believes that the fact I've kept you adjacent to my circle means you matter to me, and that things that matter to me are useful to her. I absorb this. Does she believe correctly? He looked at me directly, without deflection. Yes, he said. The rain came down softly between us. Somewhere a block away, a car horn sounded and faded. Then what do we do? I asked. We stop letting her set the terms, he said. There's a gathering next Friday. The remaining allied families, the council's neutral parties, several independent figures whose alignment hasn't been claimed. Sarah Voss will be there because she always engineers her presence where power is being decided. He paused. I want you there with me. I stared at him. I'm a waitress. You're someone who walked into the middle of this with clear eyes and made a choice that cost her nothing and could have cost her everything, he said. That's not a waitress. That's someone I trust. And right now, I need the people in that room to see who I trust. The rain fell between us, soft and relentless. I thought about small spaces and chosen invisibility. I thought about the long habit of making myself forgettable. I thought about what it meant to be seen. Not as leverage, not as a loose thread, but as someone who had been chosen to stand in a room where things were decided. What do I wear? I said. Something broke open in his expression. Not dramatically, but genuinely. A crack of something warm in all that careful steadiness. I'll have something sent, he said. The dress was deep green. It arrived Friday morning in a plain garment bag with no note, delivered by Len with the same forward economy he applied to everything. I hung it on the back of my bathroom door and looked at it while I drank my coffee. It was simple, no embellishment, no drama. But the fabric held the light in a way that made it look like something that had been chosen with specific and careful intention. I thought about that while I got ready. About intention. About the difference between being placed somewhere and choosing to stand there. I had spent most of my life in the first category, placed by circumstance, by family, by the particular shape of a childhood that had taught me to take up as little space as possible. Even this job, Embers, the apron, the invisible efficiency, had been something I'd fallen into rather than chosen. A place that needed someone reliable and uncomplaining. And I had been both of those things for so long that I'd stopped questioning whether I wanted to be. But the kitchen. That night. The back door swinging open, and the man who filled the frame, and the words that came out of my mouth before I'd finished thinking them. Keep quiet. I'll hide you in the kitchen. That had been a choice. Maybe the first genuinely unscripted one I'd made in years. I put on the green dress. I looked at myself in the mirror for a long moment. Blonde hair down for once. Loose around my shoulders. Eyes that looked less tired than I felt. I didn't look like someone from a gathering where power was being decided. I looked like myself. Which, I was slowly understanding, was exactly the point. The venue was a private hall in the east quarter of the city. Old architecture. High ceilings. The kind of room that had absorbed decades of significant conversations and retained something of their weight in its walls. By the time Len brought me there, it was already occupied. 40, perhaps 50 people moving through the space, with the particular energy of individuals who were performing ease while actually taking careful measure of everything around them. Theron was at the far end of the room when I entered. He saw me immediately. I was learning that he always saw everything immediately, that it was simply how his attention worked, and crossed toward me without hurry, without theater, just the direct and purposeful movement of a person going where they intended to go. He looked different here than he did in the study or on the rainy street corner, not changed, but fully inhabited, like a word finally used in the right sentence. "You came," he said. The same thing he'd said at the North Building, the first time. "You asked," I said, the same shape of answer. Something passed between us in that, a recognition of the pattern we'd been building, brick by brick, without either of us naming it directly. He introduced me to people. Not with explanation or context, simply with my name and his proximity, which in this room communicated everything that explanation would have taken paragraphs to convey. I shook hands, made eye contact, smiled at the right moments, the same skills I used carrying plates through a dining room, applied to a completely different kind of terrain. I met Devon, who led one of the Eastern Border families, and had the handshake of someone who had made peace with the world being hard. His wife, Marin, was small and precise, and asked me within 30 seconds of meeting me what I did. And when I told her, she nodded with no change in expression, which I appreciated more than effusiveness would have been. I met Ellis, who was perhaps 60, and served as something between an advisor and a historian for the Western Territory, a man who had watched 4 Alpha Kings take and hold their position, and who looked at me with the evaluating patience of someone adding data to a long-running equation. And I met Sarah Voss. She was already watching me when I noticed her, standing near the tall windows with a glass of water, in another expensive coat, her 2 flanking figures slightly behind her like punctuation. Her eyes found mine across the room with the precision of someone who had been tracking my location since I walked in. She came to me. That was interesting. She made the approach, which told me something about what she wanted from this interaction. She wanted to be the one who initiated. "Rose Callahan," she said. "We've met briefly." "You came to my restaurant," I said pleasantly. "You asked about an incident I hadn't witnessed." Her mouth curved slightly, not warmly. "Yes. And yet here you are." "Here I am," I agreed. She looked at me with open assessment, not bothering to disguise it, because the disguise itself would have been a concession. "He's made an interesting choice bringing you here," she said. "It says something about where his thinking has gone." "What does it say?" I asked. "That he's become attached to something outside his world," she said. "Attachments are liabilities, especially for someone in his position." I looked at her calmly. "I thought about my father and the long education and what it looked like when someone tried to make you feel that your presence was a burden. I thought about restaurants and the slow machinery of institutional invisibility. I thought about all the rooms I'd moved through quietly, carefully, taking up no space." "Or," I said, "it says that he's made an alliance with someone who isn't afraid of him, and that that's actually quite rare, and therefore quite valuable." Sarah Voss looked at me, something recalculated behind her eyes. "You're not what I expected," she said. "Most people aren't," I replied, "if you'll excuse me." I walked away from her, back straight, and found Theron near the center of the room where he was speaking with Devon and Ellis. He looked up when I approached. His eyes moved briefly to the window where Sarah Voss still stood, then back to me, with a question in them. "She approached me," I said quietly. "I think she wanted to see if I'd be unsettled." "And?" "I wasn't," I said, which was mostly true. My heart had been moving at an elevated pace for approximately 4 minutes, but that was internal, and therefore didn't count. "Ellis," who had apparently excellent hearing, made a sound that might have been approval. "Where did you find her?" he said to Theron, not unkindly. "She found me," Theron said. And the way he said it, simple, direct, without elaboration, was the most complete answer he could have given. The gathering concluded without incident, which I later understood to be its own kind of statement. Theron's presence, steady and unhurried. The Alliance families noting who stood with him. Sarah Voss leaving early, which Ellis told me afterward was not something she typically did. "The ground shifted tonight," Ellis said to me near the door as people filtered out. Not dramatically, but in the way that matters, incrementally and in the right direction. You had something to do with that. "I just stood in a room," I said. "Standing in the right room at the right time," Ellis said, "is rarely as simple as it sounds." Winter came fully in December. The bare trees in the North Building's courtyard held their ground under the first snow, thin branches catching white, the whole courtyard becoming something quiet and deliberate and still. I gave Marco my notice at Embers 2 weeks after the gathering. Not because anything dramatic had happened, but because something had shifted in me in a way that made going back to invisible efficiency feel dishonest. I told him I was moving into a different kind of work. He looked at me for a long moment and then nodded, with the expression of a person who had suspected something for a while. Celia cried slightly, which she denied. I promised to meet her for dinner once a month, and I kept that promise, every month, without fail. The three families who had pulled back from Theron's alliances, the ones Sarah Voss had quietly pressured into absence, began to return in January. Not all at once, but one by one, with the particular quality of people who had waited to see which way a thing was going to fall and had now made their determination. Davin's family reinforced their commitment formally. Ellis drafted a compact between six independent figures that effectively neutralized the council's economic pressure campaign. Sarah Voss did not disappear. That was not the kind of story this was. She recalibrated, restructured her approach, turned her attention to other leverage points. But the isolation strategy, the slow, patient work of making Theron seem like someone being abandoned, had failed. The narrative had been interrupted, and once interrupted, that particular kind of story cannot resume exactly as it was. She remained a presence. A careful, watchful one, but no longer an advancing one. By February, I had settled into the North Building not as a visitor, but as something with a less temporary quality. I worked alongside Ellis, learning the history, the structure, the careful architecture of how the Western Territory governed itself. I asked too many questions, which Ellis tolerated with great patience and occasional genuine amusement. I made decisions. Small ones at first, then larger. I stopped apologizing for taking up space. Theron and I didn't talk about what we were to each other in declarative terms. We didn't need to. It was present in the consistency of being chosen, in the way he sought my read on situations, in the way I had stopped needing him to explain himself because I had learned the language of how he thought, in the way the bare trees in the courtyard eventually, in April, put out small green leaves, and we both noticed at the same moment from the same window. "They made it through," I said. "They always do," he said. "They just look finished for a while." I looked at him. He was looking at the trees. "Is that about the trees?" I asked. "Partly," he said. I understood. I had looked finished for a while, too. Quiet and contained and taking up the smallest possible space, moving through rooms and leaving no impression. A girl who stayed late, who did the inventory, who said yes when she meant something more complicated. That version of me hadn't disappeared. She was still part of how I move through the world. The attentiveness, the ability to read a room, the habit of noticing what others missed. But those things no longer operated in service of invisibility. They had found a different purpose, a larger one. Theron turned from the window. His expression was the one I had come to know best, open and steady, without performance or deflection. The face of someone who had spent a long time being seen only as authority, and had found, against his own expectations, that being seen as a person was not the vulnerability he'd believed it to be. "The compact Ellis drafted goes to formal ratification next week," he said. "After that, the Council's position becomes significantly more complicated." "And Sarah Voss?" I asked. "Will adapt," he said. "She's intelligent. She'll find a new angle. But the territory is stable in a way it hasn't been in 3 years." He paused. "That's real. That's permanent." "Good," I said. We stood in the April light, the courtyard below us green and quiet and recovered. The building hummed its steady hum. Somewhere in the corridor, two of his people were having a conversation in low voices that carried just enough to be company without being intrusive. I thought about a back door swinging open at 11:47 p.m., about a stain on a dark coat and a question asked in a voice trained to stay level, about words that fell out of my mouth before I finished thinking them, and how the best decisions I'd ever made had all had that quality. Arriving before deliberation, rooted in something deeper than strategy. I thought about how the smallest choices were sometimes the ones that changed everything. Not the dramatic ones, not the visible ones, but the quiet ones, made alone in empty kitchens, that nobody would ever see. I thought about how I had spent years being invisible, and had walked into this life through the back door, which felt, in some final and certain way, exactly right. "What happens now?" I said. Not anxiously, just honestly. Theron looked at me the way he'd looked at me in the storage room, in the study, on the rainy street corner, completely, without the social habit of looking past someone. "Now," he said, "we build something." The April light held us both. The trees in the courtyard had come back. The territory was stable, and I was standing in the right room, which was no longer an accident. It was a choice. It had always been a choice. And for the first time in as long as I could remember, I was certain, completely, quietly, irreversibly certain, that I had made the right one.